For those who noticed the table missing who came early, the table will be there when you leave, and we would be very pleased if you would stop and become a member of Vancouver Institute. Tonight, in order to have a lecture about West Coast art, we have sought out Dr. Marjorie Halpin, a native of Florida who went to university in Washington, D.C. From our point of view, fortunately, after her BA and MA at George Washington University, she was employed at the Smithsonian Institute for 5 years. And it was there that she became interested in the art of the Indians of our coast. She then came to the University of British Columbia in order to study under the late Wilson Duff, and he has been a great influence on her work. She received her PhD here in 1973 and stayed on at this university. She has taught in the Department of Anthropology and Sociology and participated in the organization of our wonderful Museum of Anthropology. Last May, she organized the Monster Conference. She has continued her interest in the art of West Coast Indians and is now curator of ethnology at the museum. Her subject tonight is Experiencing the Mythical Image, an evening of Northwest Coast Indian art. Dr. Marjorie Halpin.
Thank you. Can you hear me? I think the more important question is, can I speak? I'm going to be showing you as powerful a group of Northwest Coast Indian images as I could write a commentary for. And I intend my comments to guide your perceptions of the art according to what I believe are some of the basic principles encoded in it. The images you will see are of objects made by the Tlingit, Haida, Tsimshian, Quaguth, and Nootkin, or West Coast people of the British Columbia and Alaska coasts. Vicki Jensen helped me put the slides together. She improved some of them and did some new photography, and Judith Gould made the drawings. Our purpose is to enhance your ability to see this art, which is now being hailed as one of humankind's great artistic achievements, although only a few years ago it was relegated to the category of curio or curiosity, which to some people it still is. Perhaps by looking carefully, we can see some reasons for this incredible reclassification. There are other dimensions to the art than the ones I will be talking about, most notably the social dimension, which we refer to when we speak of Northwest Coast images as crests. But this has been emphasized so strongly in scholarly writing that it begins to seem as if these images were no more than social badges created in stereotypic form for easy and quick recognition. So I will not mention crests, but will attempt to direct your attention to more mythic qualities in the images. According to Aristotle's distinction between history and poetry, which seems like a good place to begin a Vancouver Institute lecture, the historian makes specific and particular statements, such and such happened at such and such a time. The poet, on the other hand, does not make specific or particular statements. You do not go to a poet to find out what happened. You go to a poet to find out what happens. Similarly, myths and mythic images do not inform us about particular events and beings in the world, but about enduring essences and relationships, those things which are always true, which repeatedly happen. Thus, unlike historical beings and events, mythic beings and events do not exist or occur in time. They are before time and eternal. Nor do mythic images obey the laws which constrain beings and events existing in nature. As Claude Lévi-Strauss is showing us, they obey the same laws that govern the human mind. This evening, let us look first for time and think about how we find it in images, one before and one succeeding. This is a century of historic, irreversible time. These are not going to be photographs of the same places, but they are photographs of Indian villages and Indian people taken in British Columbia a century apart. While you are looking, I will read two quotations. In 1878, George Dawson visited the Queen Charlotte Islands and wrote as follows. These permanent villages of the Haidas are now much reduced in number, in correspondence with the very rapid decrease of the people themselves. Those villages least favorably situated as fishing stations or most remote from communication have been abandoned. I'm having a problem with the slide arrangement, but maybe I'll work it out. Even those still occupied are rapidly falling into decay. Many houses have been completely deserted, while others are shut up and moldering away under the weather. The carved posts, though one may still be erected, are as a rule more or less advanced toward decay. A rank growth of weeds, in some cases, presses close up among the inhabited houses. In a few years, little of the original aspect of these villages will remain. Ten years later, in 1897, the anthropologist Franz Boas wrote the following letter to the Quaguth people. Friends, I am Mr. Boas who is speaking to you. It is two winters since I have been with you, but I have thought of you often. You were very kind to me when I was with you. I am thinking that it is difficult for you to show to the white men in Victoria that your potlatches are good. And I have tried to show them that they are good. I am trying to do the right thing. I am trying to show them that your ways are not bad ways. I am sorry to see how many of your children do not obey the old laws, how they walk in the ways of the white man. The ways of the Indian were made differently from the ways of the white man at the beginning of the world, and it is good that we remember the old ways. Your young men do not know the history of your people. It is not good that these stories are forgotten. An especially dramatic change that we can easily see is the replacement of totem poles with gravestones. The dead are shown as white men, for the stones were carved by white artisans. But we can stop time. As traditional objects move into museums, they move out of time and out of its changes. They become eternal objects insofar as we can preserve them. Not only as matter, but as meaning. To preserve them as matter, scientists called conservators, whose specialty is removing the residues of time, remove or control light and also moisture and dirt and stress, those things which interact with an object and cause it to die. To preserve them as meaning, designers and curators control the context of the object, for we know that objects acquire meaning from their context. Normally, we try to recontextualize objects in museums by creating illusions of their original context, which some people think means an obligation to create plastic people. The point is that museum exhibits normally attempt to deny time by restoring the original condition and context of objects from the past. Museums thus permit us to time travel in a way that the marketplace doesn't. For here, the images from the past become contaminated by the present. And we are offended by this loss of cultural integrity. This is a concrete totem pole in Japan. Let us look a little closer at the relationship between meaning and context. Were I to attempt to explain this Quaggeuth mask to you thoroughly as an anthropologist, I would have to explicate for you the many relationships that are hidden in this picture, including that it was posed for a white movie maker. As an anthropologist, I would attempt to reconstruct the mask's original cultural context. So I study reported events from that cultural context, make a model of them to see how they work, describe the model in technical language for my colleagues, and then reduce it all to a label for you. The truth is found anthropologically and presented to you institutionally. This label, of course, is not from the Museum of Anthropology, but from the Peabody Museum at Harvard. The problem is that my label may be so abstract that it does not directly enhance your experience of the mask in any way. What does this do to your ability to have a direct experience of the object itself? Do you really need someone to tell you how to think and to feel about these masks? To be sure, it does increase the intensity of your response to know that this is Bukus, the chief of the ghosts and those who have drowned, that his body is cold as ice, and that his stare causes madness. It might also heighten your experience to know that some people, including some Indians, say that he is the Sasquatch. As well, it might increase your appreciation of this kind of headdress to learn that it was worn by a wealthy person. But is there nothing you can derive from your own direct experiencing of the object, or even its photographic image? According to cultural theory, you are indeed dependent upon an expert to explain objects from other cultures. For cultural theory localizes and locates all human meaning in its specific cultural tradition, so that the meaning of the Quaggeuth eagle mask derives from the context within which it was made and worn, which includes the meaning of the eagle to the Quaggeuth. But you and I also attribute meaning to the eagle, and we have enough experience of it to recognize it in exotic form. We can naturalize or familiarize it without too much trouble. We also have experience of the bear. Is our experience of the bear bowl to be found only to the extent that we share with the Haida artist an experience of the actual bear? Is that which unites us to the Haida artist only the subtraction of our bear image from his bear image? Do you see in these only what you already know? Most of us only know tame bears in cages, if we know them at all. Is that tame bear the only thing that is reaching you through this image? or this one? Okay. Is this how you know a seal, or does this bowl do something to your knowledge of a seal, an animal filled with oil? Or is it a bowl filled with oil? We have the wrong slide tray in, I think. Yeah. Are you there? Thank you. That's right. The magical red phone. According to Northrop Frye, artists in our society use images of nature for artistic reasons. Thus, he says, what you never get in literature are just the sheep that nibble the grass or the flowers that bloom in the spring, tra-la. There's always some literary or artistic reason for using them, and that means something in human life that they correspond to or resemble. Similarly, let us look at images of animals from the Northwest Coast and assume that they are about humans. That is, let us assume that they are symbolic rather than literal, that they are profound rather than trite, and that they are revealing or insightful rather than obvious. Let us begin with Raven and look for a bridge which will take us from the natural world into the realm of the mythic image. First, find the animal as you know it, the one that looks natural to you. Although someone from another culture with a different tradition for constructing images might be unable to see it. Find your raven and then move with the carver into his raven. We normally do this by looking for the most exaggerated, most extreme, most obvious part of the animal, the attribute which does not change. For Raven, it is his beak. Find that beak, and you find Raven. You remember Beaver. Find its teeth, its tail, and its paws. This time, use your initial act of recognition of the natural animal only as a first step. Allow the beaver you know to transform into the beaver you see. Now try shark and see if you can forget jaws. Its head is at the bottom under its fin, and it is looking up so that you see its great turned down mouth. In looking for shark, always look for that mouth. This one is a little bit more difficult to see. See if you can find the parts. And now frog. The major rule that we have written for frog is that it has a wide, toothless mouth. So far, I've been showing you the simple forms, the ones that stretch our minds the least, the ones that look most like our preconceptions of what nature looks like, the ones that tie us most securely to the world of appearances, the ones that we regard as the most logical, the most grammatical, the ones that illustrate the rules as written by Franz Boas and Bill Holm. Let us move now into new categories of being with the carvers, further into the mythic realm. Where does the woman end and the frog begin? They seem to be sharing the frog's front legs. Here is another frog, or is it the same one? Sharing a body with a wolf. I don't see to have any way to correct that focus, I'm sorry. Does this say that wolf and frog are opposite manifestations of the same being?
It's all right, right?
It's okay now. Thank you. It's a very complicated procedure, as you can imagine. Are these the same being? And if so, which end is which? Perhaps all double-headed beings are statements of both oppositeness, front and back, and equivalence. Perhaps front and back are somehow the same thing. What happens to our literal category of beaverness to find one with a killer whale's fin? Is the carver breaking the rules, or is he obeying another set of rules that we know little about? Here is a wolf with two fins. How can that which our rules tell us has no teeth acquire teeth and still be a frog? Or an eagle? How can a frog fly? It appears as if the carver is disengaging us from the world of common sense. How can a bear have human hands when we know that he has claws? And most incredibly, how can frog become raven? Or is it raven become frog? A being of the mind and not of nature. A mythic being from some other realm where there are different rules. Where nature and her categories are collapsing and new unities are found and expressed. We have trouble seeing two things as the same or at the same time. Is this an image of an Indian or an Eskimo? Our brain forces us to choose. To see an image as either this or that. Is it a rabbit or a duck? The visual clues are so evenly balanced that our brain cannot make up its mind. Now, the movement that you are experiencing between figure and ground, or one image and another, is one kind of transformative experience in your mind. If you could contain that movement between images, compress it into a single timeless moment, you would be in direct perception or experience of the transformative act. I believe that this is the experience the Northwest Coast Carver was attempting to depict in three-dimensional form and to trigger in the viewer's mind. Now, he showed transformation in a great many ways. I am Killer Whale. The man is feeding money to the killer whale. He has transformed money into food. This is the owl man on a totem pole. We can see his feet transforming into claws and his arms into wings. He has even been preserved in a grave monument. Here we find the transformative act between the human and the land otter, a grimacing human with a tail. This is also the transformation into drowning and madness, for this is the victim of the Buquis. Here is another carving of the same transformation. The carvers especially liked to turn opposites around. Remember, of course, that you shouldn't be able to see both of these at once, except through the use of photography. Death and life, or is it sleeping and waking, or is it normal and tranced? There's also a lot of play with the front and back of containers as the head and rear of an animal, which sometimes seems to turn into another animal. Is the human the back end of the bear? It is more subtle on a dish like this one, where the front that you are looking at is the so-called hawk with a beak, nostrils, and a mouth, that wide curve at the bottom. Its eyes turn upside down at the back. Let's not use the photography this time and see if you can keep the other end in mind as you look. I'm just trying to clear that one for now. No, it's the right tray. It's just that I don't really want that yet. It's sort of talking back to me.
When the burner turns off, doesn't it?
No.
No, press that one.
Okay, now let's start this all over again, because I'm trying to ask you to look at this box, remembering one side while you look at the other. Now, this time, we'll try a bent box which has human hands on one side. See if you can find them. And it doesn't have any hands on the other. Back and front, a rather incredible game of symmetry. To the extent that the Northwest Carver succeeds with us, he will trigger the transformative experience in us. This seems to require, beyond his incredible skill and knowledge, that we be especially able to step into or to surrender to the aesthetic image, to contain within that timeless moment the incredible similarities he asserts between contrary things, to allow his logic to destroy our logic, or, as Wilson Duff said, to surrender to the logic that only reason finds impossible. These are the two stone masks which Wilson refused to let us see at the same time in his exhibition of stone images. He insisted that the two masks be exhibited back to back. Although he knew that this is the way it happened in the power dance of the Tsimshian, when the stone eyes opened and closed. Perhaps seeing the images only one at a time gives them enough play in the mind so that they can begin unifying and transforming into each other, sliding toward that containment of paradox and the jump to a new level of meaning. Old Pierre, the Salish shaman, wrote of his initiation into power as follows. 4 winters I endure this penance. Then at last my mind and body became really clean. My eyes were opened and I beheld the entire universe. The most common motif in all Northwest Coast art is eyes, as if it was all about a special way of seeing. Many masks give the eyes special treatment. I have also argued that all masks are, at the deepest level, about death, that part of us which dies. We are that we are not. There are things our ordinary eye cannot see, things that are simply too illogical for the brain to accept in its normal critical state. Try to see how this drawing contains three prongs. See if you can follow all three prongs. Perhaps this prehistoric stone mortar is just such a figure. Here we see that the labret of the human woman, that enormous hole in her chin for an ornament, is also the cavity of both hers and the frog's body. Duff believed that this particular mortar expressed the pure logic of neither and both at the same time. What the mortar is full of, he said, is that which is common to the mouth where eating occurs, the belly where digestion and gestation occur, and the vulva where life-giving occurs. Thus, what the mortar is full of is creative transformation. This is the chief's chest in which he kept his masks, headdresses, and rattles, and other ritual garb. I believe the front of this chest to be an image of contained transformative power, that which contains and transforms flesh into food, food into wealth, wealth into prestige, life into death, and death into birth. It is pure energy. It is also three dimensions compressed into two in an interesting kind of perspective. That little round hole below the center of the two double eyes is the tip of the beak of the being on the box. It is made more explicit in this print by Robert Davidson, where the little round hole is still there, but the beak has been added underneath it superfluously. So sort of pull that beak up so that the little round hole is its tip and you were looking at it straight on. Here it is a great carved Tlingit screen. Now for the Tlingit, a single word has the meanings of womb, tomb, bivalve shell, box, and opposite clan, the basic category of containerness, that which contains life or out of which it comes, and death, for the box is also a coffin. One of Raven's births was from the body of his dead mother in her chest coffin. Here the beaked being is painted on a Simpson screen, and it is called a dragonfly, an animal with minimal body or matter and great energy. According to museum documentation, the cannibal dancers and the dog eaters came out from behind this screen and danced and ate their terrible food in front of it. Look at the four little humans on the screen. Notice that they also have that same combination of beak, nostrils, and mouth. Where do you notice the four beings to differ the most? They are almost the same. They differ most prominently in their lungs. I think this is a statement about breathing. Let us go all the way around the chief's chest and see how the back, front, and sides relate to each other. Here's the front with the now familiar beaked being. And one side. And the other. And the back. What being is this, the one on the back? It has eyes and other suggestions of a body. I think it is often the bear. Notice how similar it is to this painted bear. Now, this chest in the Museum of Anthropology is unusual in that it has no design on the back of it where the bear would be. Could we not perhaps say that the bear has pushed through the box and is coming out its front? It is essentially the same relationship that we find on a rattle, the so-called hawk on one side and the bear on the other. In this marvelous box, the back and front have become corners, but the same relationship of image to image can be found. We find the same beaked being on a chief's frontlet headdress. But if you look closely, you will see that it also contains a whale's flukes. Here are three views of Tsimshian frontlets, all well identified as the Thunderbird human monster named the Gibelk. So that the beaked being, which we see in the top frontlet, is also a manifestation of the human, which we see at the bottom. Conceptually, they are the same. You will also recall that the Bukus mask was beaked. We also find the beak being of the chest front on the belly of the raven rattle, the supreme instrument of the chief's power. Raven was born a supernatural child, the grandchild of the chief of heaven to mortal parents. Until he ate, he was not mortal, and he did not move or act in the world. His first food was a scab, a crust of blood, taken from the leg of a stranger or a giant slave. After eating the scab, Raven's adventures in the world began, spurred on by his great greed and lust. He remembered that there was light where he had come from in the house of his grandfather. He returned to heaven through the hole in the sky, which was also the latrine of heaven, and through which he had been born, reborn to the chief's daughter by his own act, he cried incessantly for the box in which light was kept. His grandfather finally gave it to him, and Raven stole it, returning to our world. Here he is shown flying with the box on his back, and a shaman, who is also a bear, is in a trance on his back. I'm sorry, the box is in his beak, and the shaman, who is also a bear, is in a trance on his back, receiving power from a frog. Here is a dead shaman who seems to have a bear's tail. And here is a dead man who seems to be turning into that beaked creature. Notice how similar the posture of the shaman is to the man on the rattle. Sometimes the frog crawls over to the belly. Now, if Raven has captured light in the box in his beak, which I assume to be the chief's chest that we have been looking at, what is he flying in? Where is he taking his riders? They must be flying in darkness, in the categoryless space that existed before light, time, and our world began. The rattle shows us, and this pipe as well, that the shaman's power over disease, death, and the future is obtained by flying into that darkness, the domain of the frog, which is neither contained nor differentiated, into that which has no categories, that which is outside of time. In this bowl, the raven and the bear human share a body which the bear human is holding open. Here, Raven holds the human in his mouth, which reminds us of Robert Davidson's contemporary silkscreen print. Let us look further at how the traditional images translate into the contemporary silkscreen print. The first thing we notice is that the images have lost their relationship to artifacts, the relationship of animal body to cultural container. We notice that most prints show only a single and thoroughly grammatical form, one that can be easily recognized. Where in such prints is the transformative act or transformative relationship? Where is that aesthetic pull toward the realm behind the categories of common sense? We find it only occasionally. For example, Robert Davidson's beaver here has a human dimension. Can you find it? Joe David's ling cod man, the man who changed into a fish, is shown here in the middle of that change, neither man nor fish, but both. We find transformation exuberantly expressed in Joe David's dancers. The serpent dancer, in which wolf, snake, and masked human are intertransforming. The welcome dancer, human and whale. The incredible crawling wolf dancer. The wolf is in the midst of a turn and is pure energy. It has become intellectualized in Robert Davidson's very Haida abstractions. He writes of the butterflies, or messengers of departed souls. The holes in the center of the designs could represent the entry into the world above and the world below, through which souls must pass in their journeys and through which messages are sent. It might be that power is also sent through that hole. But this is the print which has captured my imagination most recently. This is Doug Cranmer's Frogman. Compare it with Larry Rosso's very Canadian flying geese, three lonely birds in a great big sky. The day came when the man who put on the skin of the frog to get food from the water could no longer turn back into a man. Here we see his violent struggle to escape an eternal manifestation as frog, as neither nor. Look how difficult the transformative act has become. Now I would like to return you to linear historic time and start drawing this to a close. I see Rosso's Canadian geese flying in historic time, and Cranmer's man struggling in mythic or eternal time. Let me see if I can help you see it as I see it. In Art Thompson's Nootka Canoe series, we are not seeing the eternal act of man taking life and giving death to sea animals. These are not unifying and resonating containers for the human experience. They show particular men catching particular animals at particular times and even in particular spaces, for landscape is beginning to happen in the Northwest Coast print. That's a very particular fish jumping a very particular jump. Let's look at it another way. Here is an early oil painting by George Clutesy, done in the 1940s. And here is a housefront painting showing the traditional relationship of the thunderbird and whale. See how Clutesy has simply plunked it down into the totally irrelevant landscape where ordinary people are hunting for an ordinary whale, seemingly oblivious to the cosmic relationship of spirit and body as the giant bird of the sky catches its whale food. Clutesy allows our eye to travel back and forth from the mythic dimension to the local moment. Now look at these new prints in the Cassan style of the Upper Skeena. Not only are these prints depicting specific moments in time, they are thoroughly localized in space. Here, the landscape has become an integral part of the print. But as these prints become illustrations, they become dependent upon a story for their meaning. They require another episode before and after the particular moment in linear time before they are meaningful. They have become both literal and literate. And they are no longer mythic. Even though they are manifestly about myths, they no longer have the power to work directly upon the viewer's consciousness. Notice that all their pieces have flown apart as if their meaning had exploded. I'm reminded of some early absurd carvings in the British Museum. These look to me as if the carver was deliberately saying, for surely these are deliberately absurd, that he will show us what it feels like to have the meaning that unifies experience shattered. So the question becomes, which way will it go? And why does it matter so much to you and me? Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Halpin has agreed to answer questions. It's not practical to go back and find pictures, but we mustn't, though many would like to start over again. So questions are now in order.
Most of the carvings and drawings, the dominant color is going to be red and black, although there are others. Is there any significance to this?
The question is, the gentleman has noticed the dominance of red and black as the colors in Northwest Coast art and has asked if there is any significance to the colors. I think undoubtedly there is. I have not looked into this particularly, but there are suggestions again and again. For example, in funeral situations, people will cover their faces with black. Red is, on the other hand, associated with the shaman. So we might be looking at that kind of relationship between red and black, a very basic life and death statement. I don't know that it's been thoroughly investigated. Yes?
How much do the various images cross the various tribal boundaries? For instance, the raven with the box, was that common to all of the coastal tribes?
The question was, how often did the images cross tribal boundaries? For example, the raven rattle. Is that a common image to different tribes? Yes, that particular one appears to have spread from the Nass River in early prehistoric or protohistoric times and soon became a symbol of the chief all the way up and down the coast. The boxes, the chief's chest, were also widely traded. It's very difficult to localize many of these objects to tribe of origin, although a number of people work very hard at doing that. Yes, ma'am?
Have any of these symbols been shown in any other civilization?
Do you mean, do we find the same symbolic statements in other cultures? We don't find these particular ones, although some people think they can see them in China and other places in the Pacific. We certainly find, I think, very similar symbolic polarities or oppositions. At some level, I think these kinds of statements are very widespread. The question is, if you inherit the right to a crest, the right to represent a particular image, how do you feel if it's traded? Well, crests weren't traded. They were sometimes seized in war or given in marriage in some areas. The images that achieved a sort of standard form over a wide area were not crests. Although you will read many places that every image from the Northwest Coast is a crest image. This is simply not true. Yes?
Right at the top was the image.
The gentleman in the very back row, we can all hear you. No. The sort of ultimate ground plan, according to which the primary crest or totemic animals are related to one another, hasn't really been worked out, but they don't seem to be in dominance relationships. Yes, ma'am. Uh, Yes, but the crest images, although I don't know that Owlman is necessarily a crest image, the some of the others are, persist in the stone medium carved by white artists. The Indians would send small wooden, okay. Well, the one that's holding on in a clergyman fashion was carved by a white man. I think that the lady's question is reaching for a historical relationship between land claims and a movement toward Christian symbolism, but I haven't looked at that. Maybe we can talk later, since you seem to want to go right into that. Yes. Can't hear you. All right, the lady's question is, what can we do to help Native people? We can do probably a lot, all the way from voting to making friends to learning the historical situation that has brought the present situation, present conditions about. I don't know that I can answer that according to any particular formula, but I'm glad if the evening's presentation has prompted you to ask such a question.
Have particular families developed any particular crests? Have they been passed along from generation to generation?
Yes, the crests are normally inherited in the family. Indeed, that is the sort of primary thing that crests do, is get passed on. Sorry, that was awkward. Yes. Yeah, I think that's probably a general question. The problem with, you know, the business of crests is getting confusing. Let me put it this way. Some animal images, especially those that are clear and easily recognizable, are crests. They are owned by particular families and passed on in according to rules of inheritance to the descendants of those families. They reach back into the myth time. However, that is only some of the animal images on the Northwest Coast. Others are more general. Images of chiefly prestige or spiritual attainment, and they are not restricted in the way that crests are. And sometimes it's difficult to know whether a particular animal is a crest or non-crest The most important rule is the item upon which it occurs. Most totem pole images are crests. Most container images are not crests. It's there's rather complicated rules about that. Thank you.
I've asked Dr. Chitty to express our thanks, if you would.
On your behalf, I would like to thank Dr. Halpin very much indeed for the careful way in which she has introduced us to this enormously complicated problem, which I'm sure we've all experienced on our visits to the Museum of Anthropology. It would certainly be very nice to have Dr. Halpin to go along with us anytime we are there. I must say she has presented me, who am a zoologist, with a number of rather tricky problems of anatomy and evolutionary history. We also, with our technical setup here, have presented her with a number of difficulties in her acts of transformation. So I think the score is about equal. I think we are much impressed by the way she has organized her lecture, telling us that Aristotle pointed out that the poet is looking for things which happen. And you'll notice the symmetry as she ended her lecture, showing that in some of the best of the modern prints, this same concern, this universal human concern for what is eternal, is being shown so admirably. So thank you very much on behalf of the Institute, Dr. Halpin.
Next week, Nigel Nicholson, Virginia Woolf, A Personal Portrait.